Welcome to Color Country Politics, where we discuss all the important political issues facing Iron County, Utah. Our guests include elected officials and community leaders in or representing Iron County.
This is episode 62, The High Price of Hydration.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Color Country Politics. We're so glad that you are here. I am Jenny Hendricks, along with my co-host.
I am Jesse Harris.
And we are really excited to bring you some great information today. Our guest is Paul Monroe, who is the general manager at the Central Iron County Water Conservancy District. So Paul, welcome. Thank you so much for giving us some of your time today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
So could we just start, Paul, with, can you just tell us what is the Central Iron County Water Conservancy District? What do people need to know about who you are first?
Okay, so yeah, just a little bit about our organization. We were organized in 1997. It was voted on by the community here that's involved in the Water Conservancy District, and it's, as it's mentioned, the Central Iron, so it doesn't include the eastern side of the county of Parowan and Paraguna, and it doesn't include the Burl Enterprise section, so there's kind of this middle swath of Iron County that is part of the Central Iron County Water Conservancy District. So that's a little bit of the geographic boundaries, and then within it, the governing board that directs the district has 7 board of directors, and they are appointed by the county commission. And the mission of the district is to follow basically state statute on the Water Conservancy District Act, and that is to plan and develop and conserve water resources, and that involves anything from, you know, conservation all the way up to developing pipelines, reservoirs, water tanks, anything to do with water that will provide for our community for the next 50 years. So we are continually looking 50 years into the future to ensure that water will be available to our residents here in Iron County or Cedar Valley.
That's something that I didn't realize until I started doing some research for this episode, is that you are constantly looking 50 years out and planning for 50 years. So as our projected population is growing, you've got to do more water planning for the residential, but also agricultural. So tell us kind of what is the relationship in the Central Iron County Water Conservancy District with agriculture water and residential consumers of water?
Yeah, so, you know, we're kind of unique that way. We are a little bit of hybrid where we're municipal. We supply quite a bit of water throughout Cedar Valley, and we have good relationships with Cedar City and Enoch City, as well as Canaryville, and then we have this agricultural community that we try and support as well. Our organization within the district, our bylaws require that we have one board member who has agriculture and uses irrigation water as part of their livelihood beyond on the board. And so that's, you know, kind of a primary focus of when the board was established, that the community wanted to hold on to some of that agricultural interest as well as part of our heritage in that regard. But the makeup and the dynamics of water and the way that it's used in Cedar Valley is irrigation, understandably, uses 75% of the water, right? I mean, you consider that we've been here for over 100 years, and the primary resource is water, and that was used for crops, and that's the reason why a majority of the use still is agriculture today. So is that that region or that economic driver of agriculture has kind of been a constant here since it was first settled by our ancestors close to 100 years ago.
That's something that I don't know if people really understand, is that 75% of our available water is used by agriculture. So that leaves 25% to residential users. And that number is quite impressive, you know, to have that much going toward ag when you think about it. I mean, that's a lot of our water resource that is going to support the agriculture industry. And I can, of course, see the history, because that's how this community started. It was ag when it started. And that's where the water rights are. Is that why there's so much water devoted to ag? Because they own it?
Yeah, I think just a little rewind too of water rights and how they're distributed in the state of Utah, right? It's water rights in Utah basically stem from mining claims when the state was first organized. So if you went and you claimed a mine, you had the right to mine that resource. You were the first one there. So similarly, water rights, when the settlers came in and they settled an area and they claimed water, they had a right to use that water. So it's coined as first in time, first in right. So if you were the first one to claim it, you have the first right to the water. And that becomes very important even today as we begin looking at curtailments or the potential of water rights being restricted from what's called the groundwater management plan, or the state coming in and saying, we're not going to allow you to use these water rights anymore. So I guess one way to look at it is if we had a jug here and the first people that came, they got their first priority. And if you fill that jug up with water rights, you know, you've got water rights that go all the way to the top. But over time, we've realized that there's only this much water available half there in that upper portion, that upper half may have to go without water rights, or they may get those restricted to where they can't use them until or if ever there's enough water to supply. So that's what the state, the Division of Water Rights, has been looking at pretty seriously the last couple of years, is implementing a groundwater management plan where they will help bring our water resources back into more of a sustainable level. So I don't know if we want to jump into that right now.
And I was just going to say that's really, because that's what I deal with a lot in the real estate industry, is exactly what you're talking about. I don't know if we want to go down that rabbit hole, because there's, when you start talking about water, I mean, we could have a days long conversation. But to your point, it is affecting the real estate industry, because if you're selling either water rights or land that has the associated water with it, and they are post 1934, I want to say, it affects their value, because those are going to be the first to be taken back by the state. So that's something that in the real estate industry we're really focusing on, and it's one of the questions that we're asking, as far as, you know, if a seller comes to us and says, I've got this land, I've got this water, that's really a big part of the conversation and the valuation of what that is. But again, that's, I think, good. we could go down that road and you know, use it or lose it. There's all these different kinds of things. But I think for our purposes here, what we'd like to kind of pivot and talk more about, What are you focusing on right now that affects our community? So there's things like the Wawa Valley and the Pine Valley pipelines. There's recharge. There's conservation. And I think one thing that we really want to talk about is, what are the costs associated with kind of all of the above? So just kind of give us an overview about what your focus is right now.
Yeah, so we've got primarily four focuses that we look at, and they stem from a couple of different reports and research. We created a water advisory committee that involved multiple people in our community to review and examine our plan and our progress of what we wanted to do. And really what we've come from that over the last couple of years of analyzing that is the most important thing we can do is import water or bring new water into the basin. And so that is, you know, this project we talk about of being the the Pine Valley Water Supply Project. That will be the biggest impact to be able to help sustain and continue our abilities to grow in the valley. We'll be able to import that water. Secondly, our focus is to recharge. So recharge the aquifer, or to the best of our abilities, take the water that we have and put it back down into the ground of the aquifer and make sure that we don't lose any of that water. And then finally, kind of our third stool is to conserve water. So we always have a heavy emphasis on being able to become more efficient and conserve and encourage everyone to do that. And so those are the three items that we focus on, or that our main focus is right now within the district. So I can jump in to, or would like to jump in and talk about each of those. And maybe what I'll do is I'll start with recharge. So we only have one stream, one primary stream that makes it into Cedar Valley. It's Coal Creek. And today, I think it's running at a near historic low with the dry conditions that we've had. But luckily, we had a pretty decent winter where we were able to recharge earlier in the year. But unfortunately, it's turned off pretty dry out there. But what we do is we take excess water that those farmers, which have senior water rights, that they're not using. We take that water and we divert it into some empty gravel pits that are around the basin and put it into the aquifer. Historically, a lot of this water has kind of gone out, migrated around. A lot of it went into the ground through ditches and canals, but there was also a lot that made it out to Lake Quitchapa and Rush Lake, where there's not as big as a benefit because the lakes are impermeable or they don't allow the water to seep into the ground and make it into the aquifer. A big focus for us to getting water back into the aquifer is because we are mining our aquifer, or we're taking more water out than what's being put in. So there's annually estimated from the state, from the Division of Water Rights and the Utah Geological Survey, is we're taking as much as 7,000 acre feet per year out of the aquifer than what's being put in. Sustainably, we estimate that there's around 21,000 acre feet that's available. So if you look at your own savings account and you're putting in $21,000 into your savings account every year, but you're taking out 20, you can see over time that that's not going to be sustainable. So that's why it's a high priority for us to take every drop that we can and make sure we get it into the aquifer and recharge it and hopefully be able to sustain our aquifer here.
Let me ask you, Paul, how is that effort working? How much of that recharged water is actually going to reduce that 7,000 acre foot deficit?
That is a difficult question to answer for a lot of different reasons. But anything water, you know, something, they get a little bit complicated. But we do know exactly what we put into the ground this year. We received some grant money last year, and then the district put in quite a bit of resources as well to measure all of the irrigation companies as well as our discharges into these recharge areas. You go onto our website, you can log on right now to cicwcd.org and look at stream flows, and you can see all the different stream flows as well as our recharge zones. And you can see live data of how much is being recharged. So this year, we recharged 3,000 acre feet into those. Where it becomes difficult is trying to decipher how much of that water previously used to make it into the ground. So is it 100% net benefit of the 3,000? Well, probably not, because there was a lot more ground that was not into houses previously that people would flood irrigate and that people would put over their crops or would go in through their ditches and they would water their livestock with that as it went throughout the valley. Not as much of that happens anymore. And so there's kind of been a shift over the last 20, 40 years of that water kind of just became more channeled and going out to those lakes. Where previously a lot of it may have went into the aquifer. So we know that we put 3,000 acre feet in, but really we won't be able to determine what kind of benefit we'll be able to do for probably another year or two after, when we look at the overall aquifer and to see how it reacts. So every year the USGS, they drop a measuring tape down all of a bunch of wells throughout the valley, and they measure the depths. And there's been a declining trend for decades. And so what we hope to do is to see that flatten out a little bit. But so that's why it's difficult to determine how much we put in. And, you know, what, based on historic uses and historically what went into the ground versus what we're artificially doing, it's a little bit of an unknown.
Yeah. Well, that'll be interesting to track. I would imagine that doing a cost-benefit analysis, am I correct in thinking that recharge, if it works, is probably the least costly of our options, well, probably besides conservation. But relative to bringing in a pipeline from Pine Valley, if anyway, go ahead and finish your thoughts, because there's a lot of moving parts to this.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely... cost benefit wise, it's the programs that we have in place are pretty simple for us to be able to put water back into the aquifer and be able to save that. It's hard to say that what kind of net benefit you'll gain from that because there are existing water rights that are senior that would have priority to even the water that you recharge. So basically, the water that we are recharging. We're basically just doing a benefit to the community where we're recharging, putting water into the aquifer for the benefit of all of those that hold water rights. So
would that include the municipalities like Cedar City, or is that just private individuals, ag people? Who would be the beneficiary of that when you say people that own the water?
So it would be everybody. And the way that the water rights work, there's not a separation between an ag use or a municipal use when it comes to whether or not you'll lose your water. Mm-hmm. So I guess the biggest benefit would be is whoever's at that breaking point of I'm going to lose my water or not lose my water. You know, if you're in between that section and we're able to recharge and bump that up so you don't lose your water, it's that guy. Could be the city, could be the just a regular water right owner.
Okay, that makes sense. That's a good explanation. Thank you. Okay, what next? Do you have anything else on recharge, or should we move on to importing or conservation?
Yeah, let's talk about conservation first. We've had quite a few different conservation programs we've been a part of. We recently helped Phoenix City put in a remote drip irrigation at some of their park. So it's remote sensing where it actually senses what the plant, when it is starved for water or when it's calling for water, it will emit water to the root zone. So it's not over the air or broadcast that way. It's through pipes and sensors that are underneath the ground. So it's a new technology, a really neat technology. There's a lot of advancements in technology on that level for turf, as well as agricultural. And primarily our biggest focus with conservation is agriculture. Over the last couple of years, we've been able to obtain $200,000 with the help of our local legislators to put in more efficient irrigation systems to center pivots, and they can save as much as 20%. So we've got around 8,000 acres in Cedar Valley and center pivots. You save 20%. Potentially, you could have a savings of around 4,000 acre feet, which really cuts into that deficit. But that doesn't solve all of our answers either. So, you know, if we were able to recharge 3,000 acre feet and we cut that and conserve 7,000 acre feet, there's still this block that we're really not talking about today of water rights that are available in that groundwater management plan where there's, you know, 30,000 acre feet that's sitting out there that people could develop. So the combination of that, you've got growth that continues. And so you've got, if we were to break even today and hit that mark, You know, we're one of the fastest growing counties in the state of Utah right now. And so us looking 50 years in the future, if we were, you know, if we were to do everything we could and hit those marks, conserve as much as we could and recharge every drop that we had, you know, we've got a inclining growth that we're going to have to meet and match in the future. So
I like the fact that there's so much focus on conservation on the agricultural side. And that's something that I don't know that this community understands, that that's, you know, going back to the 75% versus the 25%. I mean, of course we need to conserve every drop that we can. But if you're talking your residential users conservation, there's no way that residential users can conserve us out of the problem that we have. You've got to go to that 75%. Have you seen that our ag users are on board with the conservation? Are they open to these different measures? Because I know that the legislature they put some money out there to help ag users. So locally, what's the sense in our ag community? Are they on board or not?
Those that have installed the units are really excited about them. I mean, they love them. And agriculture is an industry that has marginal profits. And so any efficiencies that are formed, the agriculture industry is usually all about. And so, you know, you look at what they're able to do when they put in these more efficient systems, they can reduce some of their power demand. So that reduces their cost. And then they also have the benefit of not using as much water, which primarily to them, it's the cost, right? It's the power cost. But in the long run, it's the water as well, because the deeper that they have to draw their wells down, there's an increased cost to pull that out with electricity as well. And if they run out of water, they know better than anybody that water is sustaining life, that sustains them and their livelihood. So they're definitely on board with new techniques and new efficiencies for the most part. All those that have been involved, you know, they're really excited about it. They also see increased in yield because the water is not being blown away, where the new techniques, they irrigate close to the ground. There's more drops and just is more efficient. So as far as they're concerned, I think that they're on board. And as they continue to talk to their neighbors and look to see, you know, what they're doing, I think it'll have a little bit more of a domino effect and it'll be more widespread in our valley. I also sit on the State Ag Optimization Committee, which was developed by the legislature. And there is lots of research that's going into ag optimization. And there's even more that's being driven out of places in California, like the San Joaquin Aquifer, as well as the Ogallala Aquifer over through, you know, basically Nebraska down to Texas. The two large food producing areas for our community, the United States, basically have got more serious issues than we do with overdrafting aquifers and water level declines and water shortages and scarcities in the future. So everybody in the nation is trying to become more efficient, particularly the farming and agricultural industry. And there's a lot of new products that come out annually on how to become more efficient.
So. Let me ask just one follow-up question, because I think that there was some legislation, I can't remember if it was passed or not, but I know that there was some legislation at least proposed in the last session that talked about, okay, if we're going to encourage conservation in the ag community, which means they're using less water, which means there's more water staying in the aquifer, are we bumping up against that use it or lose it law in Utah? And so there was talk about water banks and so forth. Have you seen that as an issue locally?
So I'm glad you bring it up, because use it or lose it is a term that's used loosely. And unfortunately, it's really not necessarily true. So it's something that there are lots of ways that people can do things with their water rights to protect them so they do not lose them. The easiest thing is to file a non-use application. and basically you just set it in non-use, and I think you can do that up to 6 or 7 years. So you can go and file a non-use application and basically have your water right safe and on a shelf for 6 years. So I just want to kind of clarify that. That was a tool that the state already had. The water banking bill did pass. It's, you know, you could probably tweak some things and make it useful in our area, but it's more kind of for a larger river system. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, you know, the tools are in place that people can protect their water rights. They either do need to use them or put them in non-use. Potentially, I could see some areas where you could develop some type of water bank where in our area, you know, you could create some type of market where people could rent water more easily. But at the same time, that becomes pretty difficult too. So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see for a case study how this water banking tool that the legislature came up with is actually going to work. So
it will be interesting. I appreciate that there is conversation around all of these issues, and you know, Wasatch Front issues are far different than rural issues, but they're all big issues when we talk about water. So
I mean, in some regard, they are all interconnected, as water kind of is, but there are definitely differences. I mean, we have a small stream, but we have also a closed basin, so we don't have any water that exits out of our basin, and so we're pretty unique in that regard. There's not very many basins in Utah where you're just a closed basin.
That's cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So we get to be a little
And not very cool, because that kind of means that we've never had a river that's flown through here that's big enough to exit out.
So people can't get in and take it out, but also, there's not anything else coming in as far as rivers and recharging.
There's no access.
Okay. All right. Well, what else do we need to know about conservation?
Let's see. I would just say, you know, we've done a pretty good job since 1995. We reduced our per capita per person per day down about 18%. We continue to try and bring that down. The district has passed ordinances to make it more favorable for development to occur with water rights that they are required to bring in if they'll change their CCNRs to be a conservation-minded landscape. We've got a program called Localscapes, where we have tools for individuals to put in water-wise landscaping that's beautiful and unique to Iron County. But primarily, there's a lot of that happens now. I mean, with our new landscape, new lawns, new housing and development that goes in now, you don't see as many that go in, that put in yards that's just 100% turf that goes from the foundation all the way to the curb. You know, there's definitely a lot more unique variety that's in our landscapes today, and that's helped a lot.
What can an individual do to conserve outside of any of your efforts?
So there's a whole list of things that they can do. There are state programs that we help promote. We have water smart controllers that we partner with the state to be able to provide those, so that they can, if it ever were to rain again, when it does rain, they'd be able to take that, turn on that smart water controller, and it will adjust it automatically for the amount of rain that has fallen on their ground or on their yards, and not wet water as much. And that's primarily the largest use, even within our community, is our outdoor water use. So I think we're at another 2/3 of the water that we use in Cedar Valley is used outdoors. So of that 25% that's used municipal or within the municipal and industrial portions, a majority of that is used outdoors. So, and that's only 6 months out of the year that we kind of irrigate with. So I think becoming more conscious about our footprint outdoors and our irrigating techniques, there's a lot of things that they can do there. On top of that, most of the new houses are really efficient with the new products that are available, and that's pretty much what is available is water smart products. And so we're pretty efficient with our washers and our dryers. There are some toilet rebates that are available in other areas. Primarily, I think just your common shut off the water when you brushing your tooth or brushing your teeth and taking shorter showers. Those are always little recommendations that you can think about. But going back to kind of what Jenny was saying, obviously the big low hanging fruit is being able to help agriculture become more efficient, as well as within our own landscapes.
Excellent. I know that one of the big projects you've got on your plate, and that's the next thing to move on to, is the large pipeline project to bring water from the valleys and mountains from the west and northwest of us. Yes. I know there was an article that came out, had a pretty eye-popping price tag on it. So why don't you walk us through what that's actually going to cost and how that's going to end up being built?
Yeah, so the project that we're focusing on right now is Pine Valley, our Pine Valley Water Supply and Conservation Project, and that involves bringing in water from Pine Valley North in Beaver County. So don't think of Pine Valley in Washington County. It's north and western Beaver County, and it's a really unique project in that obtained water rights. We first filed for them in 2006, and were finally approved in 2014. But those rights there will be utilized up to about 15,000 acre feet in Pine Valley, and so how we'll get those is we'll drill several wells out there, and it'll be powered by solar energy. So that's what's unique about the project and pretty neat, is that we'll utilize solar power, pump it up to a high point that's right about on the Iron County border, and from there the water will gravity flow into Cedar Valley. But the great part about that is it there becomes a green project with the solar and the resiliency of being able to utilize solar and the sustainability of the resource that's out in Pine Valley. We'll be able to pull water from there and bring it into Cedar Valley, and for probably a number of years we'll be able to idle some of our municipal wells and help restore our aquifer in Cedar Valley. So that's some of the key benefits. Also a large benefit will be just the fact that as we have another source of the valley, which has been planned for and designed a number of times, beginning in 1930 when Cedar City began the discussions and the construction design for the Kolob Reservoir project up on Cedar Mountain. Eventually that was termed not feasible. Backed out of that, and the Quail Creek project that was studied as well to be able to pump up water from Quail Creek Reservoir, and then there was a Lake Powell pipeline project that was analyzed for about a half of a decade to be able to bring water in from probably closer to a decade actually. We analyzed that, looked at bringing water in from Lake Powell that was deemed unfeasible, and so this is as we've looked at all of the options since. Nearly 100 years ago, right? And so in 1930, that's when they started looking at importing water into Cedar Valley, knowing that that there would be a need for additional water resources. This is kind of our last straw, or ability to be able to import water. We'll be able to bring in water from the West Desert, from water rights we own, so that we can sustain ourselves here. So the project itself is it's about 66 miles, and we are currently doing the engineering as well as in the kind of the startup process or the middle of the process of an environmental impact statement. So that's to adhere with the NEPA or the National Environmental Policy Act to be able to go through some the BLM with this pipeline and to import the water into Cedar Valley. So after that, we're hopeful that we'll get a decision a year from now on that EIS. And we would then begin to work on the financing of the project and design. But ultimately what we want to be, you know, we obviously want to be in a place where, depending on what is available, we want to have a project that's ready to go. And we want to be able to obtain, if available, federal funds. I know recently through the federal government, they just established another $7 billion that they put into the Water Improvement and Infrastructure Act. So, you know, when you look at times that are difficult, like right now, there's as we go through this COVID pandemic and the federal government tries to help stimulate the economy, there may be options where they put it towards infrastructure like now. And so that's why we are trying to get a project that's ready to go, is you never know what resources might be able to be available to help chop into that price tag of what the pipeline is. And so that's the focus and the reason why we're moving hard to be able to have that project ready and ready to go.
What's your estimate on the total cost?
So the estimate today for that portion is about $260 million, which it does sound like a lot, right? It sounds like a lot for our community. But if you were to compare that to what Washington County went through when they built the Quail Creek Reservoir for their first project back in the 1980s, per person and per gross domestic product that was, and per taxable income that was available out there, this project is actually less compared to what that was back in the 1980s. Additionally, you know, looking at some of the analysis per household, it may increase. Now this is, let me just back up before I say this and preface it with something, is we have several ways that we can fund this. Impact fees, we have taxes that could go to help fund this, as well as user fees. But if we were just to look at user fees alone, I'm not saying that that's what it's going to be, because it is going to be a combination of all three, as well as, I should say, four would be grants, right? There's going to be federal opportunities. But if we were to take the full package of what it is and just try and place that on existing people that are here today, it's anywhere from $65 to $70 a month that it may increase everybody's water bill to. So it is a large price number, but when you consider those that are in other places of southwestern United States, that water bill, you think of your water bill here, most people are paying around $30-$35 a month for their water. Some have bigger lawns, it's closer, you know, it's a little bit more than that. But we have water bills that are relatively cheap compared to surrounding areas. I know places in California, some of them, they're paying upwards of $800 a month for water bills. Tucson, Arizona, you know, you're a couple hundred dollars a month for a monthly water bill. So, and then you think of other utilities that you pay for. If people don't have a hard time paying, you know, $60-$70 for cable, upwards of $100-some-odd for cable, but life-sustaining property of water, we only pay $100 for. So, but that's just to give you a little bit of background of what it may potentially could cost each individual person. And again, that would be saddling it with only one way to repay that.
Yeah, certainly. I know the sticker shock is something that hit me. As I'm thinking, wow, you know, doubling or tripling the base water bill is a pretty high cost. But if it's spread out, it becomes a little bit more manageable. Plus, there's been a lot of push in the legislature to make it so that water costs are borne by users rather than spread out or subsidized via other means.
You're right. Yep. There has been a significant push lately for that.
Paul, when you talk about the users, who would the users be? Is it just Iron County residents? Does that include Cedar City? Does that include Enoch? Who is that cost spread out among? Who are the users?
Yeah, so those are some things that would be ironed out, but primarily if we kind of step back and take a look at the crunch of water rights and the water right issue. Cedar City is the entity that stands to lose the most water rights. The way that it's proposed right now, groundwater management plan is, you know, they could lose upwards of 10,000 acre feet by 2050. That's a majority of their water rights. And so we're in close collaboration with Cedar City and Enoch City, and primarily Cedar City will be kind of the drivers that will say, you know, this is a project that we're behind, and this is when we think that we're going to need it. Cedar City is also the largest entity, and they're going to be probably the biggest subscriber to that. So, and then once they say they analyze and they figure out when they want this project or when they think they need this project, you've basically got the district in Enoch City as well as Canaryville that would have to say, yeah, we're going to subscribe as well. So it's kind of when it happens, it's a you're in or you're out project.
What's the relationship in that scenario with the municipal users versus the ag users? Because it's really easy to bill municipal users. You just stick it on their bill. But the process, if for ag people, because they own the water and they're most of the time pulling it through their own well. So is that part of the conversation when we're talking about, you know, bringing this pipeline in and the costs associated with that?
Yeah, I haven't done an analysis to see what the cost would be to be able to grow and actually produce a type of crop. But in my estimation, it's probably not going to be profitable for them to be able to pay the same rates for water from Pine Valley to grow their crops. And this is just hypothesis. I'm not sure. Like I said, I haven't done the analysis. But I think it'd definitely be a lot more slimmer margins. It'd be more difficult. So I don't think that we would, if somebody came to us and said that they wanted to be a subscriber to the project, that they were going to pay for it for whatever the use may be. Say a farmer was here and they were going to lose their water rights, but they wanted to still keep on farming. We felt we had excess within that project to be able to supply and provide them water. I think that that's just another user that would help pay that bill. So I think it's a little bit preliminary to say how it would work, but, you know, just kind of 10,000 foot level, I don't know that we would have a lot of interest agriculturally to subscribe to it.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's, you know, sort kind of circling back to what you led in with, ag is absolutely part of our heritage and it's how this community was started. So, but yeah. It is interesting to have that conversation as far as the use of the water, you know, and who's using more of it. So anyway, what else do we need to know about the importing project?
I would just say there is a comment period that's currently out right now for the EIS. There's been a couple of articles that have stated that, but you can log on to the BLM's website and you have any interest of any environmental concerns that you may consider, may think that it may impact, you can do that. But I'll just say I feel like we've done a really good job analyzing what impacts might be there. And if there is an impact, we've put together a pretty stringent plan of how we can mitigate that. Primarily, the pipeline is probably 95-97% in the middle of a roadway. So as it goes out of Cedar Valley, it's primarily in a road. It goes out Iron Springs Road. So basically from 56, that's where the connection will be. It goes out Iron Springs and then tags on to Antelope Road and then to the Avon Road. And it goes all the way through the Avon Road till it hits the railroad tracks out by Lund. And then it'll cross there. And that's the only section where it goes cross country for a little bit before it gets on to the Mountain Springs Road. And then finally on Pine Valley Road, where it'll go up into our well fields. It'll be, you know, adjacent to existing two-track roadways. So We primarily don't see a lot of impact that we'll do biologically. Culturally, we're not aware of, as we went and we surveyed the entire area, we didn't run into anything really culturally. And so we feel pretty good moving forward, but if there are those that have concerns, we hope that they would bring it to our attention, how we might be able to help mitigate those issues.
And do I understand correctly, on your biological surveys, you surveyed for 45 different species?
Yeah, that's, hopefully we figured them all out, so.
I thought that was interesting. I went back and listened to the presentation you did in front of the city council, and the two species that sort of stood out in that meeting was the sage grouse and the spring snail, which I didn't know there was such a thing.
I there was a lot of new creatures that I learned about as well. So I had never heard of a spring snail either. So,
but that's really interesting.
We want to make sure that they're taken care of too.
That's right. We got to protect those spring snails.
Yes.
That's important to our, our cultural heritage. I don't know what spring snails do.
Yeah, maybe the sage grouse, I guess.
Yeah.
Jesse?
Maybe they're food for the sage grouse.
Oh, yeah. If they are, then yeah, for sure. We need to make sure that we take care of them. But really, I guess I would make a note to that on the sage grouse. I feel like we're putting together a really good sage grouse plan. Sage grouse is a threatened species. It's not yet endangered, which makes it a little bit more difficult to manage. So with a sage, with something that's endangered, they basically list what you do and what you can and what you cannot do. With the threatened species, it's almost like there's even more red tape because they don't know how to manage for it. They don't really have a great plan, but they do have mitigation efforts that you can do. And we've been creating one that's got a little bit more original. Typically, if anything has gone on west of here, power lines or things where they've maybe disrupted sage grouse habitat, they've promoted more habitat by cutting down juniper trees or something like that, planting some sagebrush. But with ours, we're actually going to be able to provide water out there in areas where their leks are, where their breeding grounds are. And in the more successful areas where they do have breeding, they have these wetland areas or these mesonic areas where they're able to get water and drink. And there's really not a lot of that available out on the valley floor. And so I know the Division of Wildlife, as well as the Fish and Wildlife and other entities that are involved, are excited about our ability to be able to bring groundwater up from 500 feet below the ground and create some areas within their existing habitat that will promote better breeding grounds.
That's great. Well, Paul, before we let you go, what else do you want this community to know about the Central Iron County Water Conservancy District and what you guys are doing?
Primarily, I would just say that our focus is here to help benefit all of the citizens here in Cedar Valley for generations to come, right? So for 50 years, and we're doing the best that we can to be able to provide and make sure that that water will be available, that it'll be clean, that it'll be safe to drink, and that you guys don't have to worry about anything but turning on the tap. So on the other side of that, I appreciate the opportunity of being on here because for most of us that wake up in the morning, we don't want to have to think about where our water came from. We just want to be able to turn on that tap and know that the water's coming out is safe to drink and that it's reliable and that it'll be here today and tomorrow. So that's our goal, is to make it make your life easy. And we don't ever really expect a call. Usually when people are calling us, it's because they've got a water shortage or the water's out. So, we appreciate the opportunity of being on here because it's definitely an issue for our area, for our basin. It's something that everybody needs to be aware of. It's something that this larger project primarily is something that we're all going to have to come together and wrap our arms around and figure out how that we can supply and provide for the future. There's an old saying from Benjamin Franklin that says, we all drink from wells that we did not dig. And so, you know, there's a lot of efforts that have been done throughout all of history of Utah where we were building water infrastructure, knowing that it was not for us or maybe even our kids, but for our grandkids. So there's been tremendous amount of efforts of water projects that have been done around the state. That's something that we're going to have to come together and focus on and realize that this project is going to be a big project, but it's going to be something that will sustain our kids and our grandkids in the future of Cedar Valley.
Very well said.
Thanks.
Jesse, did you have something? You look like you're getting ready to say something.
No, I'm just
chilling over here. Okay. Okay. All right. Well, Paul, thank you so much for coming on the Color Country Politics podcast. This has been Paul Monroe with us today at the Central Iron County Water Conservancy District. I am Jenny Hendricks along with my co-host,
Jesse Harris.
Thanks again, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Color Country Politics, a production in cooperation with Utah Politico Hub and graciously sponsored by Century 21 Prestige Realty at 121 North Main Street, Cedar City. Special thanks to Amoeba Crew for use of their song Background Indie Rock, licensed under Creative Commons. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever fine podcasts are found. Also, check out our YouTube channel where we post video of our interviews. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and our website at www.colorcountrypolitics.com.